Strings by Stephen Lee. The death of Andrea Whitman was entirely Puppet Man's doing. Without his powers, the sullen lust that a retarded boy of 14 felt for a younger neighbor girl would never have been fired into a molten white fury. By himself, Roger Pellman would never have lured Andrea into the woods behind Sacred Heart School in the suburbs of Cincinnati, and there ripped the clothing from the terrified girl. He would never have thrust that strange hardness into Andrea until he felt a sagging, powerful release. He would never have looked down at the child and the trickle of dark blood between her thighs and felt a compelling disgust that made him grasp that large, flat rock alongside them. He would never have used that stone to bludgeon Andrea's blonde head into an unrecognizable pulp of torn flesh and splintered bone. He would never have gone home with her gore splattered over his naked body. Roger Pellman would have done none of that if Puppet Man had not been hiding in the recesses of poor Roger's damaged mind, feeding on the emotions he found there, manipulating the boy and amplifying the adolescent fever that racked the body. Roger's mind was weak and malleable and open. Puppet Man's rape of it was no less brutal than what Roger did to Andrea. Puppet Man was 11. He hated Andrea, hated her with the horrible anger of a spoiled child. Hated her for having betrayed and humiliated him. Puppet Man was the revenge fantasy of a boy infected with the wildcard virus, a boy who'd made the mistake of confessing to Andrea his affection for her. Perhaps, he told the older girl, they might one day marry. Andrea's eyes had gone wide at that, and she'd run away from him, giggling. He'd begun to hear the mocking whispers the very next day at school, and he knew even as the flush burned his cheeks that she'd told all her friends. Told everyone. When Roger Pellman tore away Andrea's virginity, Puppet Man had felt the faint stirring of that heat himself. He'd shuddered with Roger's orgasm. When the boy slammed the rock into the girl's weeping face, when he'd heard the dull crack of bone, Puppet Man had gasped. He staggered with the pleasure that coursed through him, safe in his own room a quarter mile away. His overwhelming response to that first murder frightened him at the same time that it drew him. For months afterward, he was slow to utilize that power, afraid to be so rapturously out of control again. But like all forbidden things, the urge coerced him. In the next 5 years, for various reasons, Puppet Man would emerge and kill 7 times more. He thought of that power as an entity apart from himself. Hidden, he was Puppet Man. A lacing of strings dangling from his invisible fingers, his collection of grotesque dolls capering at the ends. Teddy Jimmy still scrambling, Hartman Jackson Udall wait for compromise. New York Daily News, July 14, 1976. Hartman promises floor fight, Joker's rights issue on platform. The New York Times, July 14, 1976. Senator Greg Hartman stepped from the elevator cage into the foyer of the Aces High. His entourage filed into the restaurant behind him, 2 Secret Service men, his aides John Worthen and Amy Sorensen, and 4 reporters whose names he'd managed to forget on the way up. It had been a crowded elevator ride. The 2 men in the dark glasses had grumbled when Greg had insisted that they could all make the trip together. Hiram Worster was there to meet the group. Hiram was an impressive sight himself, a man of remarkable girth who moved with a surprising lightness and agility. He strode easily across the carpeted reception area, his hand extended and a smile lurking in his full beard. Light from the falling sun poured through the large windows of the restaurant and gleamed from his bald head.
"Senator," he said jovially, "good to see you again."
"And you, Hiram." Then Greg smiled ruefully, nodding at the crowd behind him. "You know John and Amy, I think. The rest of this zoo will have to introduce themselves. They seem to be permanent retainers anymore." The reporters chuckled. The bodyguards allowed themselves thin, fleeting smiles. Hiram grinned.
"I'm afraid that's the price you pay for being a candidate, Senator. But you're looking well as usual. The cut of that jacket is perfect."
The huge man took a step back from Greg and looked him up and down appraisingly. Then he leaned closer and lowered his voice conspiratorially.
"You should give Tachyon a few hints concerning his attire. Really, what the good doctor wore here this evening?
Chestnut eyes rolled heavenward in mock horror, and then Hiram laughed.
But you don't need to hear me prattling on. Your table's ready.
I understand that my guests have already arrived. That sent the corners of Hiram's mouth down in a frown.
Yes, the woman is fine, even though she drinks too much for my taste. But if the dwarf were not here under your aegis, I'd have him thrown out. It isn't so much that he's created a scene, but he's dreadfully rude to the help.
I'll make sure that he behaves, Hiram. Greg shook his head, running fingers through ash-blonde hair. Greg Hartman was a man of plain and undistinguished appearance. He was neither one of the well-groomed and handsome politicians that seemed to be the new breed of the 70s, nor was he of the other type, the pudgy and self-satisfied old boys. Hiram knew Greg as a friendly, natural person, one who genuinely cared for his constituents and their problems. As chairman of SCARE, Greg had demonstrated a compassion for all those affected by the wildcard virus. Under the senator's leadership, various restrictive laws concerning those infected by the virus had been relaxed, stricken from the books, or judiciously ignored. The Exotic Powers Control Act and the Special Conscription were still legally in effect, but Senator Hartman forbade any of his agents to enforce them. Hiram often marveled at Greg's deft handling of sensitive relations between the public and the Jokers. Friend of Jokertown was what Time had dubbed him in one article, accompanied by a photograph of Greg shaking the hand of Randall, the doorman at the funhouse. Randall's hand was an insect's claw, and at the center of the palm was a grouping of wet, ugly eyes. For Hiram, the senator was that rare good man, an anomaly among the politicians. Greg sighed, and Hiram saw a deep weariness behind the senator's good-natured facade.
"How's the convention going, Senator?" he asked. "What chance does the Joker's rights plank have?"
"I'm fighting for it as hard as I can," Greg answered, and he glanced back at the reporters. They watched the exchange with unfeigned interest.
"We'll find out in a few days when we have the floor vote."
Hiram saw the resignation in Hartman's eyes. That gave him all the information he needed. It would fail, like all the rest.
"Senator," he said, "when this convention's over, I expect you to stop by here again. I'll prepare something special just for you, to let you know that your work's appreciated."
Greg clapped Hiram lightly on the back.
"On one condition," he replied,
"you have to make sure that I get a corner booth, by myself, alone." The senator chuckled. Hiram grinned in return.
"It's yours. Now, tonight, I'd recommend the beef in red wine. It's very delicate. The asparagus is extremely fresh, and I made the sauce myself. As for dessert, you must taste the white chocolate mousse."
Elevator doors opened behind them. The Secret Service men glanced warily back as two women stepped out. Greg nodded to them and shook Hiram's hand again. "You need to take care of your other guests, my friend. Give me a call when this madness is over."
"You'll be needing a White House chef, too."
Greg laughed heartily at that.
"You'll need to speak to Carter or Kennedy about that, Hiram. I'm just one of the dark horses in this one." "Then they're passing by the best man," Hiram retorted.
He strode off. The Aces High occupied the observation tower of the Empire State Building. From the expansive windows, the diners could gaze out to a view of Manhattan Island. The sun touched the horizon beyond the city harbor. The golden dome of the Empire State Building tossed reflections into the dining room. In the gold-green sunset, Dr. Tachyon was not difficult to spot, seated at his customary table with a woman Greg did not recognize. Hiram had been right, Greg saw immediately. Tachyon wore a dinner jacket of blazing scarlet, trimmed with a collar of emerald green satin. Purple sequins traced bold patterns on the sleeves and shoulders. Mercifully, his pants were hidden, though a band of iridescent orange could be glimpsed under the jacket. Greg waved. Tachyon nodded.
"John, please take our guests over to the table and make introductions for me. I'll be over in a second. Amy, would you come with me?"
Greg threaded his way through the tables. Tachyon's shoulder-length hair was the same improbable red as his jacket. He ran a dainty hand through the tangled locks as he rose to greet Greg.
"Senator Hartman," he said,
May I present Angela Fischetti? Angela, this is Senator Greg Hartman and his aide Amy Sorensen. The senators, the men responsible for much of the funding of my clinic.
After a few pleasantries, Amy excused herself. Greg was pleased when Tachyon's companion took the hint without any prompting from Amy and left the table with her. Greg waited until the two women were a few tables away and then turned to Tachyon.
I thought you'd like to know that we've confirmed the plant in your clinic, Doctor. Your suspicions were right.
Tachyon frowned, deep lines creasing his forehead.
KGB?
Probably, Greg answered.
But as long as we know who he is, he's relatively harmless.
I still want him out of there, Senator.
Tachyon insisted politely. He steepled his hands before his face, and when he glanced at Greg, his lilac eyes were full of an old hurt.
I've had enough difficulty with your government and their previous witch hunts. I want nothing to do with another. I mean no offense by that, Senator. You've been a good man with whom to work, and very helpful to me, but I'd rather keep the clinic entirely away from politics. My desire is to help the Jokers, nothing more.
Greg could only nod at that. He resisted an impulse to remind the doctor that the politics he claimed he wished to avoid also paid some of the clinic's bills. His voice was laden with sympathy.
That's my interest as well, Doctor. But if we simply fire the man, the KGB will have a new plant in place within a few months. There's a new ace working with us. I'll talk with him.
Do whatever you wish, Senator. I'm not interested in your methods so long as the clinic remains unaffected.
I'll see that it is.
Across the room, Greg saw Amy and Angela making their way toward them.
You're here to meet with Tom Miller?
Tachyon inquired, one eyebrow arching. He nodded his head slightly in the direction of Greg's table, where John was still making introductions.
The dwarf? Yes, he's...
I know him, Senator. I suspect he's responsible for quite a lot of death and violence in Jokertown in recent months. He's a bitter and dangerous man, Senator.
That's exactly why I want to forestall him.
I wish you luck,
Tachyon commented dryly. J.J.S. promises violence if Plank defeated. The New York Times, July 14, 1976. Sandra Phelan felt mixed emotions as Greg Hartman approached the table. She'd known that she was going to face this difficulty tonight, and perhaps had drunk more than she should have. The liquor burned in her stomach. Tom Miller, Gimli, as he preferred to be called in the J.J.S., fidgeted next to her, and she laid an unsteady hand on the thick muscles of his forearm.
Keep your fucking paws off me,
the dwarf growled.
You ain't my goddamn grandmother, Sandra.
The remark stung her more than it otherwise might have. She could only look down at her hand, at the dry, liver-spotted skin hanging loose over thin bones, at the swollen and arthritic knuckles.
He'll look at me and smile like a stranger, and I can't tell him.
Tears stung her eyes. She wiped at them savagely with the back of her hand, then drained the glass that sat before her. Glenlivet, it seared her throat all the way down. The senator beamed at them. His grin was more than just the professional tool of a politician. Hartman's face was natural and open, inviting confidence.
Excuse my rudeness in not coming right over, he said. I'd like to say that I'm very glad that the two of you agreed to meet with me tonight.
You're Tom Miller, Greg said, turning to the bearded visage of the dwarf, his hand extended.
No, I'm Warren Beatty and this here's Cinderella,
Miller replied sourly. His voice had the twang of the Midwest.
Show him your slipper, Sandra.
The dwarf cocked his head belligerently at Hartman, pointedly ignoring the hand. Most people would have ignored the insult, Sandra knew. They would have drawn back their hand and pretended that it had never been offered.
I met Mr. Beatty last night at the Rolling Stone party, the senator said.
He smiled, his hand the focus of attention around the table. I even managed to shake his hand. Hartman waited. In the silence, Miller grumbled. At last, the dwarf took Hartman's fingers in his own ham-fisted grip. With the touch, Sandra seemed to see Hartman's smile go cold for a moment, as if the contact had pained him slightly. He quickly let go of Miller's hand. Then his composure returned.
Good to meet you, Hartman said.
There was no trace of sarcasm in his voice, only a genuine warmth, a relief. Sandra understood how she had come to love this man.
It's not you who loves him. It's only Succubus. She's the one Greg knows. To him, you're just an old, shriveled woman whose politics are in question. He'll never know that Succubus is the same person, not if you want to keep him. All he'll ever see is the fantasy Succubus makes for him. That's what Miller said we have to do. And you'll obey him, won't you? No matter how much it hurts you.
Now it was her turn to shake Greg's hand. She felt her fingers trembling as they touched. Greg noticed it as well, for a faint sympathy seemed to tug at the corners of his mouth. Still, there was only curiosity and interest in his gray-blue eyes. No recognition beyond that. Sandra's mood darkened again.
He's wondering what horrible things afflict this old woman. He wonders what ugliness is sitting inside me, what horrors I might reveal if he knew me.
She signaled for another glass of scotch. Her mood continued to deepen throughout the meal. The pattern of conversation seemed set. Hartman would introduce a topic, and Miller would respond with unjustified sarcasm and scorn, which in turn the senator smoothed over. Sandra listened to the interplay without joining in. The others around the table evidently felt the same tension, for the stage remained open for the two chief players, with the others inserting their lines as if on cue. The dinner, despite the hovering solicitude of Hiram, tasted like ashes in her mouth. Sandra drank more, watching Greg. When the mousse was set aside and the conversation turned serious, Sandra was quite well drunk. She had to shake her head to clear the fog.
"Need you to promise that there will be no public displays," Hartman was saying.
"Shit,"
Miller replied. For a moment, Sandra thought that he might actually spit. The sallow, pitted cheeks under Gimli's ruddy beard swelled and his maniacal eyes narrowed. Then he banged a fist on the table, rattling dishes. The bodyguards tensed in their seats. The others around the table jumped at the sound.
"That's the same crap all you politicians hand out," the dwarf growled. "The JJS has heard it for years now. Be good and roll over like a good dog, and we'll throw you a few table scraps. It's time we were let in on the feast, Hartman. The jokers are tired of leftovers."
Hartman's voice, in contrast to Miller's, was soft and reasonable.
"That's something I agree with, Mr. Miller, Ms. Phelan."
Greg nodded to Sandra, and she could only frown in return, feeling the drag of the wrinkles around her mouth.
"That's exactly why I've proposed that the Democratic Party add the Joker's rights plank to our presidential platform. That's why I've been out trying to collar every last vote I can get for it."
Greg spread his hands wide. In another person, his speech might have had a hollow sound, a falseness. But Greg's words were full of the long, tired hours he'd spent at the convention, and that lent them truth.
"That's why I'm asking you to try to keep your organization calm. Demonstrations, especially anything of a violent nature, are going to prejudice the middle-of-the-road delegates against you. I'm asking you to give me a chance, to give yourselves a chance. Abandon your plan to march to Jetboy's tomb. You don't have a permit. The police are already on edge from the crowds in the city, and they'll move in on you if you try."
"Then sap them,"
Sandra said. The scotch slurred her words, and she shook her head.
"No one questions the fact that you care. So stop them."
Hartman grimaced.
"I can't. I've already advised the mayor against such actions, but he's adamant. March, and you invite confrontation. I can't condone your breaking the law."
"Roll over, doggy,"
Miller drawled, and then he howled loudly, throwing his head back. Around the dining room, patrons began to glance toward them. Tachyon peered at them with frank anger, and Hiram's worried face emerged from the kitchen doors. One of the Secret Service men began to rise, but Greg waved him down.
"Mr. Miller, please. I'm trying to talk realities with you. There's only so much money and help available, and if you persist in antagonizing those who control them, you'll only hurt yourselves."
"And I'm telling you that fucking reality is the streets of Jokertown. Come on down and rub your nose in the shit, Senator. Take a look at the poor creatures wandering the streets, the ones the virus wasn't kind enough to kill. The ones that drag themselves down the sidewalk on stumps, the blind ones, or the ones with two heads or four arms, the ones who drool as they talk, the ones who hide in darkness because the sun burns them, the ones for whom the slightest touch is agony."
Miller's voice rose, the tone vibrant and deep.
Around the table, jaws had dropped. The reporter scribbled notes. Sandra could feel it as well, the throbbing power in that voice, compelling. She'd seen Miller stand before a jeering crowd in Jokertown, and in 15 minutes have them listening quietly, nodding to his words. Even Greg was leaning forward, caught.
Listen to him, but be careful. His voice is that of the snake, mesmerizing, and when he snared you, he'll pounce.
That's your reality, Miller purred. Your goddamn convention's just an act. And I'll tell you now, Senator,
his voice was suddenly a shout,
the JJS will take our protests into the streets.
Mr. Miller, Greg began.
Gimli!
Miller shouted, and his voice went strident, all its power gone, as if Miller had used up some inner store.
My fucking name's Gimli!
He was on his feet, standing on his chair. In another, the posture would have seemed ludicrous, but none of them could laugh at him.
I'm a fucking dwarf, not one of your misters!
Sandra tugged at Miller's arm. He shrugged her away.
Let me alone! I want them to see how much I hate them!
Hate's useless, Greg insisted. None of us here hate you. If you knew the hours I've put in for the Jokers, all the drudge work that Amy and John have gone through...
You don't fucking live it!
Miller screamed it. Spittle flew from his mouth, dappling the front of Greg's jacket. Everyone in the room stared now, and the bodyguards lurched from their seats. Only Greg's hand held them back.
Can't you see that we're your allies, not enemies?
No ally of mine would have a face like yours, Senator. You're too damn normal. You want to feel like one of the Jokers? Then let me help you learn what it's like to be pitied.
Before any of them could react, Miller crouched. His thick, powerful legs hurled him toward the senator. His fingers curled like claws as he reached for Greg's face. Greg recoiled, his hands coming up. Sandra's mouth was open in the beginning of a useless protest. And the dwarf suddenly collapsed onto the table as if a gigantic hand had struck him out of the air. The table bowed and splintered under him, glasses and china cascading to the floor. Miller gave a high, pitiful squeal like a wounded animal, as Hiram, a molten fury on his red face, half ran across the dining room toward them, as the Secret Service men vainly tugged at Miller's arms to get him off the floor.
Damn, the little shit's heavy,
one of them muttered.
Out of my restaurant,
Hiram thundered. He bulled his way between the bodyguards and bent over the dwarf. He plucked up the man as if he were a feather. Gimli seemed to bob in the air, buoyant, his mouth working soundlessly, his face bleeding from several small scratches.
You are never to set foot in here again!
Hiram roared, a plump finger wagging before the dwarf's startled eyes. Hiram began to march toward the exit, towing the dwarf as if pulling a balloon and scolding him the entire way.
You insult my people! You behave abominably! You even threaten the senator, who's only trying to help!
Hiram's voice trailed off as the foyer doors swung shut behind him, as Hartman brushed china shards from his suit and shook his head to the bodyguards.
Let him go. The man has a right to be upset. You'd be too if you had to live in Jokertown.
Greg sighed and shook his head at Sandra, who gaped after the dwarf. Ms. Phelan, I beg you, if you've any control over the JJS and Miller, please hold him back. I meant what I said. You only endanger your own cause. Truly. He seemed more sad than angry. He looked at the destruction around his feet and sighed.
Poor Hiram, he said, and I promised him.
The alcohol she'd consumed made Sandra dizzy and slow. She nodded to Greg and realized that they were all looking at her, waiting for her to say something. She shook her gray, wizened head to them.
I'll try, was all she could mutter. Then, excuse me, please.
Sandra turned and fled the room, her arthritic knees protesting. She could feel Greg's stare on her hunched back. Floor vote on Joker's rights tonight. The New York Times, July 15, 1976. JJS vows march on tomb. New York Daily News, July 15, 1976. The high-pressure cell had squatted over New York for the past 2 days like an enormous tired beast, turning the city unseasonably hot and muggy. The heat was thick and foul with fumes,
It moved in the lungs like the Jack Daniels Sandra poured down her throat, a burning, sour glow. She stood in front of a small electric fan perched on her dresser, staring into the mirror. Her face sagged in a cross-hatching of wrinkles. Dry gray hair was matted with sweat against a brown-spotted scalp. The breasts were empty sacks hanging flat against the bony ribcage. Her frayed house coat gaped open, and perspiration trickled down the slopes of her ribs. She hated the sight. Despairing, she turned back into the room. Outside on Pitt Street, Jokertown was coming fully awake in the darkness. From her window, Sandra could see them, the ones that Gimli always ranted about. There was Lambent, far too visible with the eternal glow of his skin. Marigold, a cluster of bright pustules bursting on her skin like slow blossoms. Flicker, sliding from sight in the darkness as if illuminated by a slow strobe light. All of them seeking their small comforts. The sight made Sandra melancholy. As she leaned against the wall, her shoulder bumped a photograph in a cheap frame. The picture was that of a young girl, perhaps 12 years old, dressed only in a lacy camisole that slipped over one shoulder to reveal the upper swell of pubescent breasts. The shot was overtly sexual. There was a haunting wistfulness in the child's expression and a certain affinity to the eroded features of the old woman. Sandra reached over to straighten the frame, sighing. The paint covered by the photograph was darker than that on the walls, testifying to how long it had been in place. Sandra took another pull on the Jack Daniels. 20 years. In that time, Sandra's body had aged 2.5 times as much. The child in the photo was Sandra, the picture taken by her father in 1956. He'd raped her a year before, her body already showing the signs of puberty, though she'd been born 5 years earlier in 51. Careful footsteps sounded on the stairway outside her apartment and halted. Sandra frowned.
Time to whore again. Damn you, Sandra, for ever letting Miller talk you into this. Damn you for ever coming to care for the man you're supposed to be using.
Even through the door she could feel the faint prickling of the man's pheromonal anticipation, amplified by her own feelings for him. She felt her body yearning to respond sympathetically, and she relaxed her control. She closed her eyes.
At least enjoy the feel of it. At least be glad that for a little while you'll be young again.
She could feel the quick changes moving in her body, straining at the muscles and tendons, pulling her into a new shape. The spine straightened, oils lathed the skin so that it lost its dry brittleness. Her breasts rose as a sexual heat began to throb in her loins. She stroked her neck and found the sagging folds gone. Sandra let the housecoat fall from her shoulders.
Already? So fast tonight?
They'd been lovers for 6 months now. She knew what she'd find when she opened her eyes. Yes, her body was sleek and young, with a fleecing of blonde hair at the joining of her legs, her breasts small as they had been in her photo. This apparition, this mind image of her lover, it was childlike, but not innocent.
Always the same. Always young. Always fair. Some vision of his past, perhaps. A waif, a virgin whore.
Her fingertip brushed a nipple. It lengthened, thickening as she gasped at the touch, aroused. There was a wetness between her thighs already. He knocked. She could hear his breath, a little too fast after the climb up the 3 flights, and found that his rhythm matched her own. Already she was lost in him. She unlocked the door, slid the deadbolt over. When she saw that there was no one in the hallway with him, she opened the door fully and let him stare at her nakedness. He wore a mask, blue satin over the eyes and nose, the thin mouth below it lifted in a smile. She knew him. She needed only the response of her body.
"Greg,"
she said, and the voice was that of the child she had become.
"I was afraid that you weren't going to be able to be here tonight."
He slid into the room, shutting the door behind him. Without saying anything, he kissed her long and deep, his tongue finding hers, his hands stroking the flank of her body. When he finally sighed and pulled away, she laid her head against his chest.
"I had a difficult time getting away," Greg whispered, "sneaking down the back stairs of my hotel like some thief, wearing this mask."
He laughed, a sad sound.
"The voting took forever. God, woman, did you think I'd desert you?"
She smiled at that and took a mincing step away from him. Taking his hand in her own, she guided him between her legs, sighing as his finger entered her warmth.
I've been waiting for you, love.
Succubus,
he breathed. She chuckled softly, a child's giggle.
Come to bed,
she whispered. Standing beside the rumpled mattress, she loosened his tie and unbuttoned his shirt, biting gently at his nipples. Then she knelt before him, unlacing his shoes, taking off his socks, before unfastening his belt and slipping his pants down. She smiled up at him as she stroked the rising curve of his penis. Greg's eyes were closed. She licked him once, and he groaned. He started to remove the mask, and she stopped him.
No, leave it on,
she told him, knowing that it was what he wanted her to say.
Be mysterious.
Her tongue ran along his length again, and she took him in her mouth until he gasped. Pushing him back on the mattress and cupping him gently, she teased him into heat, following the path of his needs, his lust amplifying her own until she was lost in the spiraling, bright feedback. He growled deep in his throat and pulled her away, rolling her over and spreading her legs roughly. He thrust into her, pounding, moving, his eyes bright behind the mask, his fingers digging into her buttocks until she cried out. He was not gentle. His excitement was a maelstrom in her mind, a swirling storm of color, a gasping heat that flailed both of them. She could feel his climax building. Instinctively, she went with that welling of scarlet, her teeth clenched as his nails cratered her flesh, and he slammed himself into her again and again and again. He groaned. She could feel him voiding inside her, and she continued to move under him, finding her own climax a moment later. The whirling began to subside, the colors faded. Sandra clung to the memory of it, hoarding the energy so that she could keep this shape for a time. He was staring down at her behind the mask. His gaze traveled her body, the marks on her breasts, the red inflamed gouges of his nails.
I'm sorry, he said. Succubus, I'm very sorry.
She pulled him down beside her on the bed, smiling as she knew he wanted her to smile, forgiving him as she knew he needed to be forgiven. She kept the thread of arousal in him so that she could remain succubus.
It's all right,
she soothed him. She bent to kiss his shoulder, his neck, his ear.
You didn't mean to hurt me.
She glanced at his face, reached behind his head, and loosed the strings of his mask. His mouth sagged in a frown. His eyes were bright with his apology.
Touch him. Feel the fire in him. Comfort him. Whore.
This was the part of it that Sandra despised, the part that reminded her of the years when her parents had sold her body to the rich of New York. She'd been succubus, the best known and most expensive prostitute in the city, from 56 to 64. Nobody had known that she was only 5 when it started, that a joker had been attached to the ace she'd drawn from the wild card deck. No, they'd only cared that as succubus she would become the object of their fantasies, male or female, young or old, submissive or dominant, any body or any shape, a Pygmalion of masturbatory dreams, a vessel. No one knew or cared that succubus would inevitably collapse into Sandra, that her body aged far too rapidly, that Sandra hated succubus. She'd sworn when she fled her parental captivity 12 years before that she'd never let succubus be used again. Succubus would only give pleasure to those who had little chance for pleasure otherwise.
Damn Miller. Damn the dwarf for talking me into this. Damn him for sending me to this man. Damn me for finding that I like Greg too much. And most of all, damn the virus for forcing me to remain hidden from him. God, that dinner at the Aces High yesterday.
Sandra knew that the affection Hartman claimed to have for her was genuine, and she hated the realization. Yet her concern for the Jokers was genuine as well. And her involvement with the JJS was a deep commitment. Knowing the government, and especially Scare, was crucial. Hartman influenced the aces that were beginning to side with the authorities after long hidden years. Black Shadow, the Shaker, Oddity, the Howler. Through Hartman, the JJS had been able to channel government monies to the Jokers. Sandra had discovered the lowest bids on several government contracts. They'd been able to leak the information to Joker-owned companies. Most importantly, It was because she controlled Hartman that she was able to keep Miller from finally turning the JJS into the violent, radical group that the dwarf wanted. While she could dangle the senator from Succubus's hands, she could limit Gimli's ambition. At least, that was her hope. After the Aces High fiasco, she was no longer certain. Gimli had been grim and sullen at their meeting this evening.
"You're tired, love,"
she said to Greg, tracing the line where his light hair dipped into a widow's peak.
"You wear me out," he replied.
The smile returned, tentative, and she brushed his lips with her own.
"You seem distracted, that's all. The convention?"
Her hand slid down his body, over the stomach that age was beginning to soften. She caressed his inner thighs, using Succubus's energies to relax him, to put him at ease. Greg was always tense, and there was also that wall in his mind that he would never open. A weak mind block that would be useless against most of the aces she knew. She doubted that Greg even realized that the block was there, that he too had been touched, however mildly, by the virus. She felt the first resurgence of his passion.
"It wasn't very good there," he admitted, cuddling her to him. "The vote didn't have a chance, not with all the moderates against it. They're all afraid of a conservative groundswell. If Reagan can knock Ford out of the nomination, then the whole show's up in the air. Carter and Kennedy were both dead set against the plank. Neither one of them wanted to be stuck supporting causes they weren't sure about. As the front runners, their non-support was too much." Greg sighed.
"It wasn't even close, Succubus."
The words seemed to coat her mind with ice, and she had to fight to hold her form as Succubus. By now the word would be spreading through Jokertown. By now Gimli would know. He'd be organizing the march for tomorrow.
"You can't reintroduce the plank?"
"Not now."
He stroked her breasts, circling her areola with a forefinger.
"Succubus, you don't know how I look forward to seeing you after all this. It's been a very long and frustrating night."
Greg turned to her, and she snuggled against him comfortably, though her mind raced. Musing, she nearly missed his words.
"If the JJS insists, it's going to be very bad."
Her hand stopped moving on him.
"Yes?"
she prompted. But it was already too late. Already she could feel the tug of his lust. His hand closed on hers.
"Feel,"
he said. His hardness throbbed on her thigh. Again she began to sink into him, helpless. Her concentration left her. He kissed her and her mouth burned. She straddled his body, guiding him into her once more. Inside, trapped, Sandra railed at Succubus.
"Damn you. He was talking about the JJS.
Afterward, exhausted, Greg would say very little. It was all she could do to convince him to leave the apartment before her form collapsed and she became an old woman again. Senator warns of consequences as mayor vows action. The New York Times, July 16, 1976. Convention may turn to dark horse. New York Daily News, July 16, 1976.
"Okay, damn it! Move it over there! If you can't manage to walk, go over to Gargantua's cart. Look, I know he's stupid, but he can pull a fucking cart, for Christ's sakes!"
Gimli exhorted the milling jokers from the tailgate of a rusty Chevy pickup truck, waving his short arms frantically, his face flushed with the effort of screaming, sweat dripping from his beard. They were gathered in Roosevelt Park near Grand, the sun baking New York from a cloudless sky. The early morning temperature already in the high 80s and heading for a possible three figures. The shade of the few trees did nothing to ease the sweltering. Sandra could barely manage to breathe. She felt her age with every step as she approached the pickup and Gimli, dark circles of perspiration under the arms of her calico sundress.
"Gimli,"
she said, and her voice was a cracked and broken thing.
"No, asshole! Move it over there by Marigold! Hello, Sandra. You ready to walk? I could use you to keep the back of the group organized. I'll give you Gargantua's cart and the cripples. That'll give you a place to ride that's away from the crowds, and you can keep the ones in front moving. I need someone to make sure Gargantua doesn't do anything too fucking dumb. You got the route? We'll go down Grand to Broadway, then across to the tomb at Fulton."
"Gimli,"
Sandra said insistently.
"What, goddammit?"
Miller put his hand on his hip. He wore only a pair of paisley shorts, exposing the massive barrel chest and the stubby, powerful legs and arms, all liberally covered with reddish-brown curly hair. His bass voice was a growl.
"They say the police are gathering around the park gates and putting up barricades."
Sandra glared at Miller accusingly.
"I told you that we were going to have trouble getting out of here."
"Yeah? Piss. Fuck 'em. We'll go anyway."
"They won't let us. Remember what Hartman said at the Aces High? Remember what I told you he mentioned last night?"
The old woman folded her bony arms over the tattered front of the sundress.
"You'll destroy the JJS if you get into a fight here."
"What's the matter, Sandra? You suck the guy's cock and take in all his political crap as well?"
Miller laughed and hopped down from the pickup to the parched grass. Around them, 200 to 300 jokers milled about near the Grand Street entrance to the park. Miller frowned into Sandra's glare and dug bare toes into the dirt.
"All right," he said. "I'll go fucking look at this, since it bothers you so much."
At the wrought iron gate, they could see the police putting up wooden barricades across their intended path. Several of the jokers came up to Sandra and Miller as they approached.
"You gonna go ahead, Gimli?"
one of them asked. The joker wore no clothes, his body was hard, chitinous, and he moved with a lurching, rolling gait, his limbs stiff.
"I'll tell you in a minute, huh, Peanut?"
Gimli answered. He squinted into the distance, their bodies throwing long shadows down the street.
"Clubs, riot gear, tear gas, water cannon. Whew, the whole fucking works."
"Exactly what we wanted, Gimli,"
Peanut answered.
"We'll lose people. They'll get hurt, maybe killed. Some of them can't take clubs, you know. Some of them might react to the tear gas,"
Sandra commented.
"Some of them might trip over their own goddamn feet, too!"
Gimli's voice boomed. Down the street, several of the cops looked toward them, pointing.
"Since when did you decide that the revolution was too dangerous, Sandra?"
"When did you decide that we had to hurt our own people to get what you want?"
Gimli stared back at her, one hand shielding his eyes from the sun.
"It ain't what I want,"
he said slowly.
"It's what's fair. It's what's just. Even you said that."
Sandra set her mouth, wrinkles folding around her chin. She brushed back a wisp of gray hair.
"I never wanted us to do it this way."
"But we are."
Gimli took a deep breath and then bellowed toward the waiting jokers.
"All right! You know the order! Just keep going, no matter what! Soak your handkerchiefs! Stay in the ranks until we reach the tomb! Help your neighbor if he needs it! Okay, let's go!"
The power was in his voice again. Sandra heard it and saw the reaction of the others, the sudden eagerness, the shouted responses. Even her own breath quickened to hear him. Gimli cocked his head toward Sandra, a mocking gleam in his eyes.
"You coming? Are you going to go fuck someone?"
"It's a mistake,"
Sandra insisted. She sighed, pulling at the collar of the dress and looking at the others, who stared at her. There was no support from them, not from Peanut, not from Tinhorn, not from Zona or Calvin or File, none of those who sometimes backed her during the meetings. She knew that if she stayed behind now, any hope she had of holding Miller in check would be gone. She glanced back at the park, at the groups of jokers huddling together and forming a rough line. The faces were apprehensive, but nonetheless resolute. Sandra shrugged her shoulders.
"I'm going,"
she said.
"I'm so happy,"
Gimli drawled. He snorted his derision. 3 dead, scores injured in Joker riot. The New York Times, July 17, 1976. It was not pretty. It was not easy. The planning commission of the NYPD had made copious notes that supposedly covered most of the eventualities if the Jokers did decide to march. Those who were in charge of the operation quickly found that such advanced planning was useless. The Jokers spilled out of Roosevelt Park and onto the wide pavement of Grand Street. That in itself was not a problem. The police had blocked traffic on all through streets near the park as soon as the reports of the gathering had come in. The barricades were across the street not 50 yards from the entrance. It was hoped that the march organizers would simply fail to get the protests together, or, coming upon the ranks of uniformed cops in riot gear, they would turn back into the park where officers on horseback would disperse them. The police held their clubs in ready hands, but most expected not to use them. These were jokers, after all, not aces. These were the crippled, the infirm, the ones who'd been twisted and deformed, the useless dregs of the virus. They came down the street toward the barricades, and a few of the men in the front ranks of the police openly shook their heads. A dwarf led them. That would be Tom Miller, the JJS activist. The others would have been laughable if they were not so piteous. The garbage heap of Jokertown had opened up and emptied itself into the streets. These were not the better-known denizens of Jokertown, Tachyon, Chrysalis, or others like them. These were the sad ones who moved in darkness, who hid their faces and never emerged from the dirty streets of that district. They'd come out at the urging of Miller, with the hope that they could, in their very hideousness, cause the Democratic Convention to support their cause. It was a parade that would have been the joy of a carnival freak show. Later, the officers indicated that none of them had actually wanted the confrontation to turn violent. They were prepared to use the least amount of force possible while still keeping the marchers off the downtown Manhattan streets. When the front ranks of the jokers reached the barricades, they were to quickly arrest Miller and then turn the others back. No one thought that would be difficult. In retrospect, they wondered how they could have been so damn stupid. As the marchers approached the barrier of wooden sawhorses behind which the police waited, they slowed. For long seconds, nothing happened at all, the jokers coming to a ragged, silent halt in the middle of the street. The heat reflecting off the pavement sheened the faces with sweat. The uniforms of the police were damp. Miller glowered in indecision, then motioned forward those behind him. Miller pushed aside the first sawhorse himself. The rest followed. The riot squad formed a phalanx, linking their plastic shields, braced. The marchers hit the shields, the officers shoved back, and the line of marchers began to bow, buckling in on itself. Those behind pushed, crushing the front ranks of jokers against the police. Even then the situation might have been manageable. A tear gas shell might have been able to confuse the jokers enough to send them running back to the relative safety of the park. The captain in charge nodded. One of the cops knelt to fire the canister. Someone screamed in the crush. Then, like tenpin scattering, the first row of the riot squad went down as if some miniature tornado had blown them away.
Jesus!
One of the police screamed.
Who the fuck?
The police clubs were out now. As the jokers hit the lines, they began to use them. A low roar dinned between the high buildings lining Grand Street, the sound of chaos let loose. The cops swung the clubs in earnest as frightened jokers began to fight back, striking out with fists or whatever was at hand. The joker with the wild TK power was throwing it everywhere with no control whatsoever. Jokers and police and bystanders all were flung at random to roll in the streets or crash up against buildings. Tear gas pellets dropped and exploded like a growing fog, adding to the confusion. Gargantua, a monstrous joker with a comically small head set on his massive body, moaned as the stinging gas blinded him. Hauling a wooden cart with several of the less ambulatory jokers set in it, the childlike giant went berserk, the cart careening after him with his riders clinging to the sides desperately. Gargantua had no idea which way to run. He ran because he could think of nothing else to do. When he encountered the reformed police line, he pummeled wildly at the clubs that struck him. A blow from that clumsy, huge fist was responsible for one of the deaths. For an hour, the formless battle swirled within a few blocks of the park entrance. The injured lay in the streets, and the sound of sirens wailed, echoing. It was not until mid-afternoon that any semblance of normalcy could be restored. The march had been broken, but at a great cost to all involved. That long and hot night, the police patrolling Jokertown found their cruisers pelted with rocks and garbage, and the ghostly shades of jokers moved in the back streets and alleys with them. Glimpses of rage-distorted faces and raised fists, futile, frustrated curses. In the humid darkness, the residents of Jokertown leaned down from fire escapes and open windows in the tenements to throw empty bottles, flower pots, trash. They thudded against the roofs of the police vehicles or starred the windshields. The cops stayed judiciously inside their cruisers, the windows up and the doors locked. Fires were set in a few of the deserted buildings, and the firefighting crews that came to the calls were assaulted from the shadows of nearby houses. Morning came in a pall of smoke, a veil of heat. In 1962, Puppet Man had come to New York City and there found his nirvana in the streets of Jokertown. There was all the hatred and anger and sorrow that he could ever wish to see. There were minds twisted and sickened by the virus. There were emotions already ripened and waiting to be shaped by his intrusions. The narrow streets, the shadowed alleys, the decaying buildings swarming with the deformed, the innumerable bars and clubs catering to all manner of warped, vile tastes. Jokertown was thick with potential for him, and he began to feast, slowly at first, and then more often. Jokertown was his. Puppet Man perceived of himself as the sinister, hidden lord of the district. Puppet Man could not force any of his puppets to do anything that went against their will. His power was not that strong. No, he needed a seed already planted in the mind, a tendency toward violence, a hatred, a lust. Then he could place his mental hand on that emotion and nurture it, until the passion shattered all controls and surged out. They were bright and red-hued, those feelings. Puppet Man could see them even as he fed on them, even as he took them into his own head and felt the slow building of a heat that was sexual in intensity. As the pounding, shimmering flare of orgasm came while the puppet raped or killed or maimed. Pain was pleasure. Power was pleasure. Jokertown was where pleasure could always be found. Hartman pleads for calm. Mayor says rioters will be punished. New York Daily News, July 17, 1976. John Worthen came into Hartman's hotel room from the connecting door of the suite.
"You're not gonna like this, Greg," he said.
Greg had been lying on his bed, his suit jacket thrown carelessly over the headboard, his hands behind his head as he watched Cronkite talk about the deadlock convention. Greg turned its head toward his aide.
"What now, John?" "Amy called from the Washington office. As you suggested, we gave the problem of Tachyon's Soviet plant a black shadow. We just heard that the plant was found in Jokertown. He'd been strung up to a street lamp with a note pinned to his chest. Pinned through his chest, Greg. He wasn't wearing any clothes. The note outlined the Soviet program, how they're infecting volunteers with the virus in an effort to get their own aces, and how they're simply killing the resulting jokers. The note went on to identify the poor schmuck as an agent. That's all. The coroner doesn't think that he was conscious through most of what the jokers did to him, but they found parts of the guy up to 3 blocks away."
"Christ," Greg muttered. He let out a long breath. For a long minute, he lay there as Cronkite's cultured voice droned on about the final vote on the platform and the obvious deadlock between Carter and Kennedy for the nomination.
"Has anyone talked to Black Shadow since?"
John shrugged. He loosened his tie and opened the collar of his Brooks Brothers shirt.
"Not yet. He'll say that he didn't do anything, you know, and in his own way he's right."
"Come on, John," Greg replied. "He knew damn well what would happen if he tied the guy up with that note on him. He's one of those aces who think they can do things their way without worrying about the laws. Call him in. I need to talk with him. If he can't work our way, then he can't work for us at all. He's top dangerous." Greg sighed and swung his legs over the side of the bed, rubbing at his neck.
"Anything else? What about the JJS? Have you managed to reach Miller for me?"
John shook his head.
"Nothing yet. There's talk that the Jokers will march again today. Same route and all, right past City Hall. I hope he's not that stupid."
"He'll march," Greg predicted. "The man's hungry to be in the limelight. He thinks he's powerful. He'll march." The senator stood and bent over the television set. Cronkite went silent in mid-sentence. Greg stared out the windows. From his vantage point in the Marriott's Essex House, he could look down at the green swath of Central Park caught between the towers of the city. The air was stagnant, unmoving, and the blue haze of pollution hid the further reaches of the park. Greg could feel the heat even with air conditioning in the room. Outside, it would be sweltering once more. In the warrens of Jokertown, the day would be unbearable, rendering already quick-fused tempers even shorter.
"Yes, he'll march,"
Greg said again, softly enough that John did not hear it.
"Let's go to Jokertown," he said, turning back into the room.
"The convention?"
John inquired.
"They won't settle anything for days yet. That doesn't matter at the moment. Let's collect my shadows and get going."
"Jokers, you're being dealt a bad hand," from a pamphlet handed out by JJS workers at the July 18th rally. Gimli exhorted the crowds under the brilliant noon sun. After the night of chaos in Jokertown, the mayor had put the city's police force on double shifts and canceled all leaves. The governor had placed the National Guard on standby. Patrols stalked the borders of the Jokertown district, and a curfew was imposed for the following night. The word that the JJS would attempt another march to Jet Boy's tomb had spread quickly through Jokertown the previous evening, and by morning, Roosevelt Park was swirling with activity. The police stayed away after two unsuccessful attempts to sweep the Jokers out of the park resulted in broken heads and five injured officers. There were simply more of the Jokers willing to march with the JJS than the authorities had predicted. The barricades were set in place on Grand Street once more, and the mayor harangued the assembled Jokers via bullhorn. He was roundly jeered by those at the gates. From the rickety dais they'd erected, Sandra listened to Gimli as the dwarf's strong voice swept the Jokers up in its ferocity.
"You've been trampled, spat upon, reviled like no other people in history,"
he exclaimed, and they screamed their agreement. Gimli's face was rapt, shiny with sweat, the coarse strands of his beard dark with the heat.
"You're the new niggers, Jokers. You're the new slaves, the ones begging for release from a captivity no worse than that of the blacks. Niggers, Jews, communists, you're all those things to this city, this country."
Gimli flung an arm toward the ramparts of New York.
"They would have you stay in your ghetto. They would have you starve. They want you to be kept in your place so they can pity you, so they can drive down the streets of Jokertown in their Cadillacs and their limousines and look out the windows saying, 'God, how can people like that stand to live?'"
The last word was a roar, and it echoed through the park, all of the Jokers rising to shout with Gimli. Sandra looked out on the mass of people, speckling the lawn under the glaring sun. They'd all come out, the Jokers, pouring from the streets of Jokertown. Gargantua was there, his immense body bandaged, Marigold, Flicker, Carmen, 5,000 or more like them all behind. Sandra could feel the excitement pulsing as Gimli lectured them, his own bitterness snaking out like a poison into the air, infecting them all.
"No," she wanted to say. "No, you can't listen to him. Please. Yes, his words are full of energy and brilliance. Yes, he makes you want to raise your fists and pump them skyward as you march with him. Still, can't you see that this is not the way? This is not the revolution. This is only the madness of a man."
The words echoed in her mind, but she could not speak them. Gimli had caught her in his spell with the others. She could feel the arc of a smile on her chapped lips, and around her the other members of the cadre were yelling. Gimli stood at the front of the dais, his arms wide as the shouts became louder and louder, as a chant began to rise from the massed throat of the crowd. "Joker's rights! Joker's rights!" The beat hammered at the waiting ranks of police, at the inevitable crowd of bystanders and reporters. "Joker's rights! Joker's rights!" Sandra heard herself saying it along with the others. Gimli jumped down from the dais, and the burly dwarf began to lead them toward the gates. The crowd began to move, a mob with no pretense of order. They spilled out of Roosevelt Park from the gates into the side streets. Taunts were shouted toward the waiting line of police. Sandra could see the flashing lights of the cruisers, could hear the drone of the trucks with the water cannon. That strange, undefinable roar she'd heard the day before was rising again, louder even than the continuing chant. Sandra hesitated, not knowing what to do. Then she ran toward Gimli, her legs aching.
"Gimli,"
she began, but she knew the complaint was hopeless. His face was a leer of satisfaction as the protesters spilled from the park into the street. Sandra looked down toward the barricade, toward the line where the police waited. Greg was there. He stood in front of the barricades, several officers and the Secret Service men with him. His shirt sleeves rolled up, his collar open, and his tie loosened. He looked weary. For a moment, Sandra thought that Miller would march past the senator. But the dwarf stopped a few yards from the man. The marchers came to a ragged, uneasy halt behind him.
"Get the fuck out of the way, Senator,"
Gimli insisted.
"Get out of the way, or we'll just trample you underneath with all your goddamn guards and reporters."
"Miller, this isn't the way."
"There is no other way, and I'm tired of talking about it."
"Please, let me talk just a few minutes more." Greg waited, glancing from Gimli to Sandra to the others of the JJS in the crowd.
I know you're bitter about what happened to the Joker's rights plank. I know that the way the Jokers have been treated in the past is disgraceful, but damn it, things are changing. I hate to counsel you to have patience, but that's what this needs.
Time has run out, Senator,
Miller said. His mouth gaped open with a grin. The crowns of his teeth were dark and pitted.
If you go forward, you'll guarantee a riot. If you'll go back to the park, I can keep the police from interfering any further.
And just what the hell good does that do us, Senator? We'd like to rally at Jet Boy's tomb. That's our right. We'd like to stand on the steps and talk about 30 years of pain and torment for our people. We'd like to pray for the ones who died and let everyone see by looking at us just how goddamn lucky the ones who died were. That's all. We ask for the rights that any other normal person has.
You can do all of that in Roosevelt Park. Every one of the national papers, all the networks will cover it. That's a guarantee as well.
That's all you have to bargain with, Senator? Ha! It ain't much!
Greg nodded.
I know it, and I apologize for it. All I can say is that if you'll turn your people back into the park, I'll do what I can for you. For all of you!
Greg spread his hands wide.
That's all I can offer. Please, tell me that it's enough.
Sandra watched Miller's face. The shouting, the chanting continued behind their backs. She thought that the dwarf would laugh, would jeer at Greg and push his way on past to the barricades. The dwarf shuffled bare feet on the concrete, scratched at the thatch of hair on his wide chest. He stared at Greg with a scowl, rage in his deep-set eyes. And then, somehow, he took a step back. Miller's gaze dropped, and the tension in the street seemed to dissolve.
All right, he said.
Sandra almost laughed. There were amazed protests from the others, but Gimli swung around to them like an angry bear.
Damn it, you fucking heard me! Let's give the man a chance! One day, no more! It ain't gonna hurt us to wait one more day!
With a curse, Gimli pushed his way back into the crowd, heading toward the park gates once more. Slowly, the others turned to follow. The chant began again, half-heartedly, and then died. Sandra stared at Greg for a long time, and he smiled at her.
Thank you, Greg said in a quiet, tired voice. Thank you for giving me a chance.
Sandra nodded. She could not speak to him. She was afraid that she would try to hug him, to kiss him.
You're just an old crone to the man, Sandra, a joker like the rest.
How did you do it?
She wanted to ask him.
How did you make him listen when he'd never listened to me?
She could not frame the questions, not with that old woman's mouth, not with that old woman's voice. Sighing, limping on swollen knees, she made her way back. Hartman defuses riot. Talk with JJS leader gains reprieve. The New York Times, July 18, 1976, Special Edition. Jokertown in Chaos. New York Daily News, July 19, 1976. The JJS rally returned to Roosevelt Park. Through the rest of the sultry day, Gimli, Sandra, and the others gave speeches. Tachyon himself appeared to address the crowd in the afternoon, and there was a strange festival atmosphere to the gathering. The Jokers sat on the grassy knolls of the park, singing or talking. Picnic lunches were shared with those nearest. Drinks were poured and offered. Joints could be seen making the rounds. In a sense, the rally became a spontaneous celebration of Jokerhood. Even the most deformed Jokers walked about openly. The celebrated masks of Jokertown, the anonymous facades behind which many of the Jokertown residents were accustomed to hide, were dropped for the time. For most, it was a good afternoon, something to take their minds off the heat, off the paucity of their existence. You shared life with your fellows, and if your troubles seemed overwhelming, there was always someone else to look at or talk to who might make you feel that things were not quite so awful after all. After a morning that had seemed doomed to violence and destruction, the day had turned gentle and optimistic. The mood was one of hilarity, as if some corner had been turned and the darkness was left behind. The sun no longer seemed quite so oppressive. Sandra found that her own mood was elevated. She smiled. She joked with Gimli. She hugged and sang and laughed with the rest. Evening brought reality. The deep shadows of Manhattan skyscrapers slid over the park and merged. The sky went ultramarine and then stabilized as the sky glow of the city's lights held back full darkness, leaving the park in a hazy murk. The city radiated the day's heat back into twilight. There was no relief from the heat, and the air was deathly still. If anything, night seemed more oppressive than day. Later, the police chief would point to the mayor. The mayor, in turn, would point to the governor, whose office would claim that no orders originated there. No one seemed certain just who had ordered the action, and later it simply didn't matter. The night of the 18th exploded into violence. With a shout and a blare of bullhorns, the insanity began. Mounted police, followed by club-wielding lines, began to sweep the park from south to north, intending to drive the Jokers onto Delancey and then back into Jokertown. The Jokers, disoriented and confused at the unexpected attack and urged on by the frantic Gimli, resisted. A club-swinging melee ensued, hampered by the darkness of the park. For the police, anyone without a uniform was fair game. They ranged through the park, striking anyone they could touch. Screams and cries punctuated the night. Gimli's attempt at organizing the resistance broke down quickly, and small groups of the Jokers were herded toward the streets, any who turned beaten or maced. Those who fell were trampled. Sandra found herself in one of those crowds, panting, trying to keep her balance in the jostling flight, her hands over her head to protect herself from the clubs. She managed to find temporary safety in an alley off Stanton. There, she watched as the violence spread out of the park and into the streets. Small scenes drifted past her. A CBS cameraman was filming as a dozen policemen on motorcycles pushed a group of Jokers toward a railing that shielded the ramp of an underground parking garage across the street from Sandra. The Jokers were running. Some of them jumped over the railing. Lambent was among them, illuminating the scene with the phosphorescent glow of his skin, a pitiful target unable to hide from the oncoming police. He vaulted the railing in desperation, plunging into the 8-foot drop beyond it. The police saw the cameraman then. One of them yelled, "Get the fucking camera!" And the cycles wheeled around with a throaty rumble, the headlights arcing across the buildings. The cameraman began to run backward away from them, still filming. A club lashed out as the police went past. The man rolled in the street, moaning as the camera tumbled to the pavement, its lens shattered. A Joker stumbled by the mouth of the alley, obviously dazed, holding a blood-soaked handkerchief to his temple, though the cut gaped open down past his ear, soaking the collar of his shirt. It was obvious how he had been caught. His legs and arms were canted at all the wrong angles, as if they'd been pasted on his trunk by a drunken sculptor. The man hobbled and lurched, the joints bending backward and sideways. Three cops came walking quickly alongside him.
"I need a doctor,"
the Joker said to one of them. When the officer ignored him, he tugged at the sleeve of the uniform.
"Hey,"
he said. The cop pulled a can of mace from its holster on his belt and sprayed the contents directly into the Joker's face. Sandra gasped and sank deeper into the alley. When the police kept walking, she fled the other way. Through the night, the violence spread out in the Jokertown streets. A running battle raged between the authorities and the Jokers. It was a spree of destruction. A celebration of hate. No one slept that night. Masked Jokers confronted the lurking cruisers, overturning some of them. Burning cars illuminated intersections. Near the waterfront, Tachyon's clinic looked like a castle under siege, ringed by armed guards with the distinctive figure of the doctor himself running about, trying to keep some semblance of sanity in the night. Tachyon, along with a few trusted aides, made forays into the streets to pick up the injured, both Jokers and policemen. Jokertown began to come apart, dying in fire and blood. Tear gas fumes drifted through the streets, acrid. By midnight, the National Guard had been called in and issued live ammunition. The scare offices of Senator Hartman issued a call for those aces working for the government to aid in calming the situation. The great and powerful Turtle hovered over the streets like one of the war machines in George Pal's War of the Worlds, sweeping the combatants away from each other. Like many of the other aces, he seemed to take no side in the confrontation, using his abilities to break up the running battles without subduing either Jokers or police. Outside Tachyon's clinic, where by 1 a.m. the wards were nearly full and the doctor was beginning to bed down the injured in the corridors, the Turtle picked up a wrecked, burning Mustang and hurled the car into the East River like a flaming meteorite, trailing sparks and smoke. He prowled South Street, shoving rioters and guardsmen in front of him as if he wielded an invisible giant plow. On 3rd Street, the guardsmen had rigged jeeps with wire mesh covers and attached large frames of barbed wire to the fronts of the vehicles. They used these to move crowds of jokers out of the main avenue and into the side streets. Spontaneous fires triggered by a hidden joker exploded the gas tanks of the jeeps, and guardsmen ran screaming, their uniforms aflame. Rifle fire began to chatter. Near Chatham Square, the sound of the rioting began to swell to immense, ear-shattering proportions as the Howler, dressed all in yellow, stalked the chaotic streets, his mouth open in a wail that contained all he had heard, amplified and redoubled. Where the Howler walked, jokers flung hands over ears, fleeing from this torrent of noise. Windows shattered when Howler raised the frequencies. Walls shivered as he sobbed in the bass range. "Stop this!" he raged. "Go inside, all of you!" Black Shadow, who had revealed himself as an ace only a few months before, indicated his sympathies quickly. He watched the conflict silently for a time. On Pitt Street, where a band of beleaguered jokers fought with taunts, thrown bottles and the garbage at hand against a water cannon and a squad of guardsmen with bayonets fixed to their rifles, Black Shadow stepped into the fray. The street went instantly black for perhaps 20 feet around the ace with a navy blue uniform and orange-red domino mask. The impenetrable night persisted for 10 minutes or more. Screams came from inside the well of dark, and jokers fled. When the darkness moved off and the lights of the city again reflected from the wet pavement, the guardsmen lay in the street unconscious, the water cannon pouring a harsh stream into the gutters, unattended. Sandra saw that last confrontation from the window of her apartment. The violence of the night frightened her. To escape the fright, she twisted the cap from the bottle of Jack Daniels on her dresser, pouring a long, harsh slug down her throat. She gasped, wiping at the back of her mouth with her hand. Every muscle in her body protested. Her arthritic legs and hands shot agony when she moved. She went to bed and lay down. She could not sleep. The sounds of rioting drifted in from the open window. She could smell smoke from nearby fires and see the shuddering flames dancing on her walls. She was afraid that she would have to leave the building. She wondered what she would try to save if it came to that. There was a soft knock at her apartment door. At first, she was not certain that she heard it. It was repeated, quiet and persistent, and she groaned to her feet. As she approached the door, she knew who it was. Her body felt it. Succubus felt it.
"No,"
Sandra whispered to herself.
"No, not now."
He rapped on the door again.
"Go away, please, Greg,"
she said, leaning against the door, keeping her voice quiet so he could not hear the old woman's tones in it.
"Succubus?"
His voice was insistent. His arousal tugged at her, and she wondered at it.
"Why now? Why here? God, I can't let him see me like this, and he won't go away." "Just a minute,"
she said, and she let down the barriers that caged Succubus. Her body began its change, and she felt the swirling of his passion inciting her own. She stripped away Sandra's clothes, flinging them away into a corner. She opened the door. Greg was masked, his entire head covered with a grotesque, smiling clown's face. It leered at her as he pushed his way inside. He said nothing. His hands were already unzipping his pants, pulling out his stiffening cock. He did not bother to undress, engaged in no foreplay at all. He pushed her down onto the hardwood floor and jammed himself into her, thrusting with gasping breaths as Succubus moved under him, matching his ferocity and cooperating with this loveless rape. He was brutal. His fingers dug into her small, firm breasts, the nails tearing small, bleeding crescents of skin. He crushed her nipples between thumb and forefinger until she cried out. He desired pain from her tonight. He needed her to cringe and cry, and yet to be the willing victim. He slapped her face. When she brought her hands up to stop him from doing it again, her nostrils drooling blood, he twisted her wrist viciously. And when he was done with her, he stood over her looking down, the clown's head laughing at her, his own face unreadable behind the mask. She could see only his eyes, glistening as he stared at her.
"It had to be that way,"
he said. There was no apology in his voice. Succubus nodded. She had known that and accepted it. Sandra wailed inside her. Hartman zipped up his pants. The front of his shirt was soiled with blood and their fluids.
"Do you understand it all?"
he asked her. His voice was gentle, calm. It begged her to listen, to sympathize.
"You're one person who accepts me without my having to do anything. You don't care that I'm a senator, I don't have to.
He stopped and brushed at his suit.
You love me. I can feel that. You care for me, and I don't have to make you care. I wish...
He shrugged.
I need you.
Perhaps it was because she could not see his face. Perhaps it was because his roughness, when before he had always been so tender, had driven Succubus's empathy deeper into him than in the past. But she could feel his thoughts for a moment as he left her sprawled on the floor, and what she sensed made her shiver despite the awful heat. He was thinking of the rioting outside, and in the senator's mind was no loathing, no distaste. There was only a glow of pleasure, a sense of proprietorial accomplishment. She glanced at him in astonishment.
It's been him, all along. It's been him using us, not the other way around.
At the door, Greg turned and spoke to her.
Succubus, I do love you. I don't think you can understand that, but it's true. Please, believe that. I need you more than I need all the rest.
Behind the mask, she could see the brightness of his pupils. She was astonished to see that he was crying. Somehow, with all the strangeness Sandra had witnessed during this night, that did not seem so strange at all. Puppet Man found that his safety lay in anonymity, in the appearance of innocence. After all, none of the puppets ever knew that he had touched them. None of them could tell anyone what had happened inside their minds. They had simply snapped. Puppet Man had only let them act out their own feelings. There was always ample motivation for whatever crimes his puppets might commit. If they were caught, no matter. In 1961, graduating from Harvard Law School, he had joined a prestigious New York law firm. In 5 years, after a successful career as a criminal lawyer, he moved into politics. In 1965, he was elected New York City Councilman. He was mayor from 68 to 72, when he became New York Senator. In 1976, he saw his chance to become president. In the past, he'd always thought in terms of 80, of 84. But the Democratic National Convention went to New York in the bicentennial year, and Puppet Man knew that here was his moment. The groundwork had all been laid. He had fed many times from the deep cup of bitterness inside Tom Miller. Now he would drink fully. 15 dead as Jokertown burns. The New York Times, July 19, 1976. The morning sun was misted by dark smoke. The city broiled under the renewed heat, worse than the days before. The violence had not ended with the morning. The streets of Jokertown were awash in destruction, littered with the detritus of the night's turmoil. The rioters fought guerrilla battles with the police and guardsmen, hampering their movements through the streets, overturning cars to block intersections, setting fires, taunting the authorities from balconies and windows. Jokertown itself was ringed with squad cars, jeeps, and fire equipment. Guardsmen in full gear were stationed every few yards on 2nd Avenue. Along Christie, the guards massed around Roosevelt Park, where once again the Jokers were gathering. Gimli's voice could be heard deep in the crowd, haranguing them, telling them that today they would march no matter what the consequences. All of the Democratic candidates made an appearance near the stricken area, to be photographed with concerned, stern expressions as they gazed at the burnt-out shell of a building, or spoke with a not-too-misshapen Joker. Kennedy, Carter, Udall, Jackson, they all made certain they were seen and then took their limos back to the garden, where the delegates had cast two inconclusive rounds of votes for the candidacy. Only Hartman came and stayed near Jokertown, chatting with the newsmen and trying unsuccessfully to coax Miller out from the depths of the crowd to negotiate. At noon, with the temperature touching three figures and a breeze from the East River bringing the smell of burning to the city, the Jokers came out of the park. Greg had never handled so many puppets before. Gimli was still the key, and he could feel the dwarf's raging presence maybe 100 yards back into the crowd of Jokers that filled Grand. In this swirling mess, Miller alone would not be enough to turn the Jokers back at the right time. Greg had made certain that he'd been able to shake the hands of the JJS leaders over the past few weeks. Every time, he'd used that contact to plunge into the mind before him and open the pathways that would allow him access from a distance. A mob was like any herd of animals. Turn enough of the leaders, and the rest would inevitably follow. Greg had most of them. Gargantua, Peanut, Tinhorn, File, perhaps 20 others. A few of them, such as Sandra Phelan, he'd ignored.
The old woman reminded him of someone's decrepit grandmother, and he doubted her ability to sway the mob. Most of the puppets already had a fear in them. It would be easy to use that, to expand that fright until they turned and fled. Most of them were reasonable people. They wanted confrontation no more than anyone else. They had been goaded into it, Hartman's doing. Now he would undo it, and in the process make himself the candidate of choice. Already the tide of the convention had turned away from Kennedy and Carter. With the delegates now absolved of their first vote commitment, they were free to elect the candidate of their choice. In the last ballot, Hartman had placed a rising third. Greg smiled despite the cameras aimed toward him. The rioting of the night before had given him a pleasure that he had not thought he would ever feel. So much passion had nearly overwhelmed him, a strange melding of lusts. The line of guardsmen began to shift as the Jokers approached. They spilled out all along the length of Christie, shouting slogans and brandishing signs. Bullhorns blared orders and curses back and forth. Greg could hear the taunts of the Jokers as the guardsmen formed a line of bayonets. At the intersection of Delancey Street, Greg saw the hovering shell of the Turtle above the guardsmen. There, at least, the protesters were kept back without harm. Farther south toward the main gates, where Hartman stood in a circle of guards, it was not so easy. The Jokers came on, pushing and shoving, the mass of those behind propelling those who might have otherwise turned back into the park. The guardsmen were forced to make a decision. Use the bayonets, or try to push the Jokers back with linked arms. They chose the latter. For a moment, it looked as if some balance had been reached. Then the ranks of guardsmen began to slowly bend. With a cry, a knot of Jokers broke through the line and reached the street. Shouting, the rest poured through. Once again, a running battle ensued, disorganized and confused. Hartman, well back from the fighting for the moment, sighed. He closed his eyes as the impressions of his puppets began to reach him. If he wished, he could have lost himself then, could have plunged into that roiling sea of emotion and fed until satiated. But he could not wait that long. He had to move while there was still some form to the conflict. Gesturing to the guards, he began to move forward toward the gates, toward the presence of Gimli. Sandra was with the rest of the main cadre of the JJS. As she marched through the main gate, she tried again to tell Gimli about that strangeness she'd sensed in Hartman last night.
He thought he was controlling all of this. I swear it, Gimli.
Just like any other fucking politician, old woman. Besides, I thought you liked him.
I do, but...
Look, why the hell are you here?
Because I'm a Joker. Because the JJS is my group, too, whether I agree with what you're doing or not.
Then shut up, damn it! I've got a lot to handle here.
The dwarf glared at her and moved away. They were walking at a slow, funereal pace toward the waiting guardsmen. Sandra could see them through those in front of her. Then the vision was gone as the Jokers crowded into the constriction of the gates, hobbling, limping, making their way as best they could. Many of them bore signs of the struggle of the day before, heads wrapped in bandages, slings. They proffered them to the guardsmen like badges of honor. The bodies in front of Sandra suddenly halted as they hit the line of guardsmen. Someone shoved her from behind and she almost fell. She hugged the person before her, feeling leathery skin under her hands, seeing lizard-like scales covering a massive back. Sandra cried out as she was crushed, pushing away with feeble arms, muscles wobbling inside loose bags of skin. She thought she would fall, when suddenly the pressure was released. She staggered. Her eyes caught the sun then. She was momentarily blinded. In the confusion, she could see fists swinging in front of her, accompanied by shouts and cries. Sandra began to retreat, trying to find a way past the conflict. She was shoved, and when she struck back, a club slammed against the side of her head. Sandra screamed. Succubus screamed. Her vision was lost in swirls of color. She could not think. She held her hands over the cut, and the hands felt odd. Blinking away blood from the cut on her temple, she tried to look at them. They were young, those hands. And even as she gaped at them in confusion, she felt the sudden intrusion of other passions.
No. Go back inside, damn you. Not here. Not in the streets. Not with all these people around.
Desperately, Sandra tried to place the controls back on Succubus, but her head rang with the concussion and she could not think. Her body was in torment, shifting fluidly in response to everyone about her. Succubus touched each of the minds and took the shape of its sexual desires. She was first female, then male, young and old, thin and fat. Succubus wailed in confusion. Sandra ran, her shape altering with each step, pushing against the hands that reached out for her in sudden, odd lust. Succubus responded as she had to. She took the thread of desire and wove it into passion. In an ever-widening circle, the rioting ended as jokers and guardsmen alike turned to pursue the quick tug of desire. Succubus could feel him as well, and she tried to make her way toward Greg. She didn't know what else to do. He controlled this. She knew that from last night. He could save her. He loved her. He had said so. The cameras followed Senator Hartman's progress toward the gate, where a few scuffles were just beginning. When his bodyguards tried to hold the senator back, he shrugged their hands aside.
"Damn it, someone has to try,"
he was heard to say.
"Ooh, good stuff,"
one of the reporters muttered. Hartman pushed forward. The bodyguards looked at one another, shrugged, and followed. Greg could feel the presence of most of his puppets in the area near the gate. With the turtle holding back the jokers at the other end of the park, Greg realized that this would be his best opportunity. Getting Gimli and the others to retreat now would turn everyone back. If the rioting continued into the night again, no matter. Greg would have quite amply demonstrated his calm sure-headedness in a crisis. The papers would be full of the account the next morning, and all the networks would feature his face and name prominently. That would be enough to ensure the nomination with a grand momentum into the campaign itself. Ford or Reagan, it wouldn't matter who the Republicans chose. Keeping his face grim, Greg strode toward the center of the conflict.
"Miller!"
he shouted, knowing the dwarf was close enough to hear him.
"Miller, this is Hartman!"
As he shouted, he gave a tug at Miller's mind and closed down that molten heat of rage, laving it with cool azure. He felt the sudden release, felt the beginning of the dwarf's disgust at the vision around him. Hartman twisted the mind again, touching the core of fright in the man and willing it to grow, a cold whiteness.
"It's out of control," Greg whispered to the man. "You've lost it now, and you can't get it back unless you go to the senator. Listen, he's calling for you. Be reasonable." "Miller!"
Greg called again. He felt the dwarf begin to turn, and Greg pushed the guardsman in front of him aside so that he could see. Gimli was to his left, but even as Hartman began to call to him, he saw the Joker's attention shift away toward the gate. There, pursued by a crowd of jokers and guardsmen, Greg saw her. Succubus. Her form was erratic, 100 faces and bodies flickering on her as she ran. She saw Greg in that same instant. She cried out to him, her arms outstretched.
"Succubus!"
he shouted back. He began to shoulder his way toward her. Someone caught her from behind. Succubus twisted away, but other hands had her now. With a shrill scream, she fell. Greg could see nothing of her then. There were bodies all around her, shoving, striking each other in their fury to be near her. Greg heard the grotesque, dry crack of bone snapping.
"No!"
Greg began to run. Gimli was forgotten. The riot was forgotten. As he came nearer to her, he could sense her presence, could feel the pull of her attraction. They piled on top of her, the swarming, snarling mob pummeling her, tearing at Succubus and each other in an attempt to find release. They were like maggots wriggling over a piece of meat, their faces strained and fierce, their hands clawed as they pawed at Succubus, thrusting. Blood fountained suddenly from somewhere below the writhing pack. Succubus screamed, a wordless, shrill agony that was suddenly, eerily cut off. He felt her die. Those around her began to pull back, a horror on their faces. Greg could see the body huddled on the ground. A thick smear of blood spilled around it. One of the arms had been ripped completely from its socket. Her legs were twisted at strange angles. Greg saw none of that. He stared only at her face. He saw the reflection of Andrea Whitman lying there. A rage grew in him. The intensity of it swept everything else aside. He could see nothing around him, not the cameras, not his bodyguards, not the reporters. Greg could only see her. She had been his. She had been his without having to be a puppet, and they had taken her from him. They had mocked him, as Andrea had mocked him years ago, as others had mocked him who had also died. He had loved her as much as he could love anyone. Greg grasped the shoulder of a guardsman who stood over the body, his cock hanging down from unzipped pants. Greg jerked him around.
"You asshole!"
As he shouted, he struck the man in the face repeatedly.
"You goddamn asshole!"
His fury spilled out from his mind unrestricted. It flowed to his puppets. Gimli bellowed, his voice as compelling as ever.
You see? See how they kill!
The Jokers took up the cry and attacked. Hartman's bodyguard, suddenly fearful as the violence was renewed, dragged the senator away from the combat. He cursed them, resisting, fighting to be loose, but this time they were adamant. They pulled him back to the car and his hotel room. Hartman enraged at killing. Attacks demonstrators. Carter appears to be winner. The New York Times, July 20th, 1976. Hartman loses head. Must sometimes fight back, he says. New York Daily News, July 20th, 1976. He salvaged what he could from the fiasco. He told the waiting reporters that he'd simply been appalled by what he'd witnessed, by the unnecessary violence done to the poor succubus. He'd shrugged his shoulders, smiled sadly, and asked them if they, too, might not have been moved by such a scene. When they finally left him, Puppet Man retired to his room. There, in the solitude of his room, he watched the proceedings on television as the convention elected Carter as his party's next presidential candidate. He told himself that he didn't care. He told himself that next time it would be his. After all, Puppet Man was still safe, still hidden. No one knew his secret. In his mind, Puppet Man lifted a hand and spread his fingers. The strings pulled. His puppets' heads jerked up. Puppet Man felt their emotions, tasting the spice of their lives. For that night, at least, the feast was bitter and galling.